New Yorker editor David Remnick has written several acclaimed nonfiction books, including a biography of Muhammad Ali. Now he's written about the life of President Barack Obama in a new book called The Bridge. Author Susan Jane Gilman has this review.
In many ways, David Remnick's new book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, is very much like its subject, even-handed, eloquent, beautifully packaged. The problem is Remnick has taken on a nearly impossible task. The Bridge attempts the most complete account yet of the most famous man on the planet, a man scrutinized daily by the media, whose life is still a work in progress, and whose biography is known to most of us already. For all his skill, Remnick is largely boxed in. His biography is well researched and articulated, but contains nothing earth-shattering. How can it? Without resorting to tabloid journalism, the best Remnick can do is elaborate on the facts, delve into the footnotes, expand upon the broader historical contexts. And here's where The Bridge is strongest. You learn about the Kenyan airlift that brought Obama's father to study in the United States. You hear Jimi Hendrix blasting in Obama's freshman dorm. You see his restlessness, confidence, and ambition laid bare. You go door to door with him as he learns to finesse Chicago's South Side. His mentors, roommates, predecessors, we meet them all. In a particularly sobering section, Remnick notes that 12 American presidents owned slaves, 8 while in office. He resurrects this with slaves' own accounts. At its best, The Bridge enriches Obama's life story with background and fine detailing. But there's another problem. Obama's rise has been so recent that it's hardly history yet. Most of the people reading The Bridge will have witnessed his ascent in real time. The section of the book that recounts the 2008 election seems to restate the obvious. And his life and presidency are still unfolding. In trying to bring us up to the minute, Remnick risks obsolescence. His epilogue, just written in January, is already out of date. Yet, oddly, The Bridge may be ahead of its time. The events in it are so well known right now that its scholarship may resonate better in 20 years after Obama's presidency has truly become history. Future generations who haven't just lived through what the book documents may find it riveting. The Bridge, in short, may be like young wine, requiring time for its full value and quality to emerge. Or it may be like Obama's Nobel Peace Prize, a massive achievement that may have been issued prematurely.
Susan Jane Gilman is the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. You can find more book reviews and recommendations at our website, npr.org. This is NPR. Too many people are getting risky and expensive back surgery when more minimal approaches would work. That's according to a new study out today in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Overuse of medical care is just one of the reasons the nation's health bill is so high. NPR's Joanne Silberna reports on the study and whether the new health overhaul law will change things.
Options for people with back pain range from physical therapy to relatively simple surgery to extensive surgery where several vertebrae are fused together. In recent years, studies have shown that the extensive surgery is rarely called for. Richard Dio of the Oregon Health and Science University and several colleagues checked Medicare data to see if doctors have been paying attention.
What we found was the most complex type of back surgery has increased dramatically between 2002 and 2007. With a 15-fold increase.
15-fold, even though there's no reason to believe there's been an increase in the number of people who need the most complex surgery. And Dio found another problem.
What we also found was that this more complex type of surgery is associated with a substantially higher risk of life-threatening complications.
Like heart attacks, strokes, and blood clots. Dio offers several possible reasons for the surgery's popularity. Some doctors may believe it works better in everyone, despite the evidence. Doctors get paid more for the 90 minutes or so it takes to do a simple surgery to clean out the bony growth that can compress nerves. The fee is around $600 to $1,000. The fee for a 5 or 6 hour fusion of multiple vertebrae is 10 times as high. Eugene Carrigy, professor of orthopedic surgery at Stanford University, offers one more reason.
The marketing incentives are all going the other way.
That is, manufacturers of the screws and other devices used during the complex surgery promote it heavily. So how do you get doctors and patients to pay attention to studies that show that a simpler approach works better than a more complex one?
Well, that's the $64,000 question.
The new health overhaul law takes a few stabs at it. One provision gets at that marketing issue. Under the new law, payments from manufacturers to doctors to promote their products will be public information. So if a doctor has a connection to a company, you can find out. Another provision creates an institute to look at how one therapy compares to another. The law explicitly says that the institute's conclusions cannot be used to determine whether insurance will cover a procedure. Still, Carrigy says just having the information available will be a big help to doctors and patients trying to make decisions. James Weinstein thinks so, too. He's an orthopedist from Dartmouth who did some of the original studies on back surgeries. But he says the new law on its own doesn't do enough.
Just having insurance and having a computer doesn't change healthcare. It's put some tools in place, but now we have to change the delivery system.
That is, find a way to pay doctors and hospitals other than for each procedure. That way they'll pay more attention to comparison studies. There are some pilot projects on that in the new law, but nothing big. Meanwhile, orthopedic surgeon Eugene Carrigy suggests for patients who are advised to get the complex spinal fusion, make sure your doctor has a good reason for the recommendation. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Los Angeles is home to the nation's largest Catholic archdiocese, and it's about to get a new archbishop. He'll be replacing Cardinal Roger Mahoney. He's set to retire early next year. The new archbishop is Latino, and as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, that's an important milestone for the church.
2 days after he celebrated Easter Mass in the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels, Cardinal Roger Mahoney was back to welcome his successor, Archbishop Jose Gomez of San Antonio, Texas. Gomez says he was looking forward to his new assignment and loved the friendliness of L.A.
The warmth of the people here gives life to the words we so often hear. We are not really strangers here, but only friends who have not met.
Gomez will serve jointly with Cardinal Mahoney until Mahoney retires, as the church mandates, on his 75th birthday in February.
This is a seismic, epic move for the life of the church in the United States.
Rocco Palmo is a blogger who chronicles news of the Catholic Church. He says Gomez's appointment will be particularly important for the nation's Latino Catholics.
He was born in Mexico. He knows what it means to have made the journey and to have come to this country.
The 58-year-old Gomez was born in Monterrey, Mexico, and came to the United States as a priest more than 20 years ago. He holds 3 university degrees, including a doctorate in theology. In 1978, he was ordained in the conservative Opus Dei Order and then served as a parish priest in San Antonio, Houston, and Denver. Abe Levy, religion writer for the San Antonio Express News, says Gomez has been seen as a comer in the church hierarchy for years.
He's a loyalist to the church. I mean, he's a doctrinal conservative, so he's in line with Pope Benedict and his leanings. You know, he's a good match for moving up in leadership.
The Los Angeles Archdiocese is definitely a move up and a challenge. It has the largest Catholic population in the U.S., and it paid out a staggering $660 million to plaintiffs who say they were victims in the world's largest acknowledged series of priestly sex abuse. In July 2007, an emotional Cardinal Mahoney made this mea culpa.
I apologize to anyone who has been offended, who has been abused in the Catholic Church by priests, by deacons, religious men and women, or lay people in the church.
Religion writer Abe Levy says Gomez will have to find a way to concentrate on other important things, such as poverty, immigrants' rights, and strengthening the Catholic laity.
He'd rather focus on those issues than sex abuse scandals and other things, of course. But he will deal with those other issues in his very sort of methodical and quiet way.
A large mass and reception are planned next month to formally introduce the next archbishop to the region. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
This is NPR.
And one wonders what people will do with all those old TiVos once the new device comes along. Apparently, lots of people have old cell phones rattling around desk drawers, or they've thrown them out. Each year, Americans toss out 130 million cell phones to the dismay of the Environmental Protection Agency. This week, the EPA has launched a campaign with mobile phone companies to preach the message of recycling. NPR's Elizabeth Chogren reports.
A Sprint video on YouTube uses ridicule and humor to urge people to recycle their cell phones. It compares throwing away your cell phone to keeping the door on your refrigerator open to cool down your house.
Is it me or is it getting warm in here?
You want me to turn up the fridge?
Mm-hmm.
You'd never be this wasteful, would you?
Other companies are trying a softer approach. Samsung is holding a sweepstakes for schools and providing teaching materials about recycling. Kim Titus represents Samsung Telecommunications America.
We're targeting schools because we think that's where the passion point is. This is the group that really will get excited about holding drives to recycle phones.
The winning school will get a private concert with rock group Hey Monday. Others will win cash. Samsung hopes to bring in 1 million phones. The EPA says recycling those phones would reap 75 pounds of gold, 772 pounds of silver, and 35,274 pounds of copper. It also would save energy and cut water and air pollution, including greenhouse gases. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Senate returns to work next week, and at the top of its agenda, overhauling financial regulations. At the heart of the effort is putting an end to government bailouts of big banks and financial institutions. But as NPR's Jan Itzde reports, it's unclear if the proposals under consideration will do the job.
There's no shortage of demands from taxpayers to end bailouts like those for AIG, Citigroup, and the other big banks.
Why can't we let the big banks fail and take their lumps?
I would like to see some checks and balances, you know, all the money we're giving to the banks. No, let them fail.
Wall Street and the bankers, yeah, the government bailing them out like they're too big to fail. So somebody's got to stick up for the little guy.
Those were two callers from NPR's Talk of the Nation, Bruce and Paul, and between them, Sandra Morris at a Tea Party rally near Dallas. Politicians, of course, are vowing never again. Here's Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd, a Democrat from Connecticut.
Never again should the American taxpayer be asked to write a check because of an implicit guarantee that the federal government will bail out a company when it collapses.
Senator Dodd's bill would try to end too big to fail by using a number of tools. Most important, it would penalize financial firms that get too big by requiring them to hold more capital. Economist Charles Calamiris of Columbia University explains.
It's a buffer. It's something that absorbs loss. That's the main function of capital.
So having more capital makes firms less likely to fail. Lots of economists support this approach, including Harvard's Ken Rogoff. But Rogoff is troubled that Congress is apparently going to leave it to regulators to decide just how much capital big banks need to set aside.
I've spoken to a number of people in the financial industry who are very pleased that it's all being left to the regulators, partly because they think they'll end up being less than if Congress were to force it in now.
The proposal also sets out a new process for shutting down big failing firms. The Fed chairman, the Treasury secretary, and the head of the FDIC would together decide when a firm should be put into bankruptcy. Their action would be reviewed by a panel of three bankruptcy judges. If necessary, the FDIC would be in charge of breaking up the firm and selling its assets. Shareholders could be wiped out, and creditors could also take a hit. To protect taxpayers, big financial firms would be taxed to create a permanent $50 billion fund that could be used by the FDIC to wind down big failing firms. But Charles Calamiris thinks the process would encourage bailouts, not end them.
Because it takes all of the apparent losses away from being borne by the taxpayers. It makes bailouts much more likely.
If it appears the industry is paying the cost, says Calamiris, government officials will be much more likely to shut down troubled firms. But he says taxpayers will still bear the losses indirectly, because the big firms paying into the resolution fund will just pass on that cost to their customers. Republicans especially share this concern. Calamiris argues this issue could be largely resolved by taxing big banks to pay for bailouts after they occur rather than before. That would give bankers an incentive to lobby against unnecessary bailouts, he says. But Ken Rogoff, who's a former chief economist at the IMF, says that idea is flawed.
The classic problem with taxing banks after the crisis is you can only tax the healthy ones. So the sick ones don't have any money, and the healthy ones are typically in trouble.
In Rogoff's view, the Dodd proposal isn't perfect, but is headed in the right direction. Another former IMF chief economist disagrees. Simon Johnson, who's written a new book on the crisis called 13 Bankers, thinks more radical action is required.
We can't cut our biggest firms down to a more reasonable size, a size at which they can fail, then we will not make any progress at all on this issue.
Despite the industry's arguments, Johnson says there's no evidence that allowing banks to grow ever larger is good for the economy.
It's good for the bankers who run the banks. They get bigger bonuses. They have more glorious empires. It does not benefit society, and it shouldn't be allowed.
Johnson argues that if new legislation does not cap the size of big banks, a repeat of the wrenching crisis we've just experienced is inevitable. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
We're in the first full week of April, which means it's baseball season again. And it's Wednesday morning, which means it's time for Frank DeFord.
Because baseball begins as life afield is renewed, tra-la, you can always count on two things this time of year. One, in trees, the sap is rising. Two, in baseball, the sappiness is rising. Yes, as sure as the flowers are a-blooming again, every team has a chance. Whereas that is true in the NFL, the NBA, and the NHL, baseball is more like American Idol or Dancing with the Stars, where it's understood from the start that some competitors just don't have a prayer. As sure as we kind of sort of suspected that Tom DeLay or Jerry Springer really didn't have a legitimate chance to win the Terpsichorean Championship against beautiful, young, and agile dancers, the reality in baseball, as long as there is no salary cap to equalize things as there is in our other popular team sports, the reality is that the Yankees and a few other rich teams are going to buy championships while little old mid-major cities really can't compete. Come on, let's admit it. Baseball is the national pastime only if hedge funds are the national livelihood. If this had to be illustrated any more starkly, a British survey just revealed that the Yankees pay their players, on average, more than any other team in the world. More significant, no other plutocrat franchise in the top dozen is a baseball team. Baseball law really does allow the Yankees to be in a league of their own, along with their money bag runner-ups, the Boston Red Sox. The AL East is so stacked that Commissioner Bud Selig has floated the idea that maybe some desperately poor franchises could be temporarily reassigned to that division, not to improve their chances, you understand, but just to give them more paydays, losing before big crowds to Boston and New York. The only way for the three geographical losers in the AL East, Tampa Bay, Baltimore, and Toronto, to have any chance is to be both wise and lucky in drafting amateur players, which the Rays have managed magnificently. But don't mess with the fat cats. When Tampa's young homegrown players dared win the division 2 years ago, the Yankees immediately went out and signed the best hitter and the two best free agent pitchers and thereby bought the 2009 pennant. Sure, quirky things can happen in the playoffs. But at this opening day, we are only reminded again that for all of baseball's welter of statistics, it remains a sport without a salary cap, so ultimately, the only numbers that really matter are the ones that follow the dollar sign.
Frank DeFord, still batting 1,000. He joins us each Wednesday.